I was surprised at how successful Guardians of the Galaxy was, but I haven't seen it. I did finally see Frozen.
You just saw Frozen?
Yeah.
People need to let that go, man.
A few nights ago. I definitely thought the best part of the movie was actually just the quality of the songs. The songs were, I thought, well written and
catchy.
And
well integrated into the story. And Let It Go is the best part of the movie.
It really is. Although even there, you're like, you know, she's basically self-banished from her kingdom, and then she starts the song, and my wife looks at me and goes, "Well, that transition went quickly." I guess she's okay with it now.
I honestly didn't really like Frozen. It's not a bad movie to me, but it's just kind of mediocre.
I am surprised
it's such a phenomenon.
Well, when I think about why is this the number one highest grossing Disney animated film of all time,
it's
now,
huge. I watched it in the theater with some friends, and if it hadn't become such a phenomenon later, I would have forgotten about it by the time I got home. It's not that it's a bad movie, but to me it just seems like, make a list of all the animated movies that have come out in the last few years, and I would just lump it in there with the rest. It doesn't seem like anything special.
They definitely
me.
Tried to play some twists on the traditional story arcs of Disney films, and requiring the kiss of the one true love, or the kiss of true love sacrifice, something like that. What I thought was interesting is whatever other variation you tend to see, the victim, you have a victim, okay, afflicted by something, and they can only receive this kind of redemption or salvation or rescue from an outside source. There's mm-hmm. nothing they can do themselves, whereas here, it's entirely what's done by that character.
Uh-huh.
Which is an interesting kind of change as far as how people, I don't know, as far as what appeals to audiences. I think that's interesting. You're like, well, she saved herself. Yeah, I don't know. I just thought it is definitely an odd phenomenon.
It's just one of those things that was just meant to be. You know, I guess it was just the right thing at the right time, the right place, and the right people saw it, and it was just one of those things that kind of happened, I guess. Guardians of the Galaxy, on the other hand, that's one of those unlikely, you know, really obscure Marvel property that's now becoming, like, so many people who otherwise would never have heard of these characters are like, oh, I love that movie, and there's going to be a sequel, and it's probably going to be a semi-big thing. But that's actually a pretty good movie, like I was saying before we started recording. It's dumb fun, but it's pretty well done dumb fun. It really is really entertaining. You enjoy the characters. It's really... By the end of the movie, I don't really care about the story. I'm not even really sure I was clear on a lot of the... what are they trying to get exactly? But it's fun. The characters are really fun. But looking ahead, this is our Silverchair Wishlist podcast.
It is our Silverchair Wishlist podcast.
We got a little interrupted with the Lady of the Green Kirtle name saga there, but this is the promised wishlist podcast.
Yeah, where we basically said, send us a wish list. It can be one item, maybe try to keep it to maybe three at the most. And we got a few responses. Definitely some we'll go over. And you and I kind of came up with three. Mm-hmm. Really, we came up with a little bit more than three just in case it was a bit redundant, because we still don't know what the others is yet.
We both Rillian and I have come up with three things we like to see in the Silver Chair movie, and we don't know. We haven't talked to each other about it, so this will be really spontaneous. Three things we want to see in the Silver Chair movie.
Mm-hmm. We tried to be specific because... the best Silver Chair movie ever was on number one on my list, but obviously...
super faithful to the book, number one.
I even tried to say, avoid things like a well-done script. So literally, like, well, that's just appreciate
a suggestion that might actually be kind of helpful.
Right, right. So how about since...
You want to do Rose's question first, actually? The audio question?
Yeah, since we are kind of already on that subject. Yeah. Let's go ahead and listen to Rose's question. This is from Rose Tree Dryad.
Hi, NarniWeb podcasters. This is the Rose Tree Dryad from NarniWeb Forum. One of my main wishes for the Silverchair film is for the scriptwriters to use as much dialogue from the book as possible. I've often felt that one of the greatest mistakes in the VDT adaptation was the fact that they used so little dialogue from the book in the script. For example, the daughter Ramandu's explanation about the Sleeping Lords was beautiful in the book, and they completely rewrote it in the film for no good reason. Please, Silverchair scriptwriters, make use of as much of the original dialogue as you can. Lewis was a master with words, and between scenes like when Jill meets Aslan, to Rillian's ravings, to the Green Witch's attempted enchantment of our heroes, and just about every line that ever comes out of Puddlebum's mouth, the book is full of incredible dialogue just waiting to be spoken on the silver screen.
Well, Rose Tree, I think that that's a very... I definitely hear you there, and I think that that definitely ties into one of the items that probably... I'm not going to say it's the number one on my list, but it came to me first when I was just thinking about it. And that is... If I were to say, look, there's one scene that I care more about than any other scene, having dialogue really lifted straight from the pages, that is the scene with Jill and Aslan at the river.
I immediately knew what you were going to say.
Partly because I've thought about some scenes where the dialogue is excellent in the book, but I'm not convinced it could work well. It might actually constrict the film, and I would never want that, but I'm convinced that this dialogue would not.
That it would not constrict the film.
That it would not constrict the film. I think it would be excellent dialogue, whether on the pages or on film.
The scene where Jill meets Aslan, it's very likely my favorite scene in the entire series, mainly because of the dialogue. And so much of it, I love how mysterious Aslan is, and he behaves, and we talked all about this in the book commentary a few episodes ago, but it really behaves in a way you don't expect.
And it would be difficult because, you know, there's not a lot you can do with, it's not like Aslan can roar or jump up and grab someone or, the dialogue is going to have to be the performance. Yep. There's so many things that will have to be done right. But I think that one of the greatest helps to that scene would be the dialogue. I just think about, like, in some ways, I almost wish that the scene that they kept the dialogue most verbatim from the first movie would have been the scene with Peter, Susan, and the professor.
Yeah.
You know, where they just kind of rush
through. And they kind of gave you the cliff notes, basically. Yeah, and that's kind of what I'm worried about. With that scene, that's a very long and developed dialogue scene, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where he says, oh, either Lucy's lying, or she's crazy, or she's telling the truth. And that's kind of all they do in the movie, is give you the bullet points. And so what I'd be concerned, I have the same concern with this scene, that they'll just say, hey, you, here, drink some water. Here's the four signs. Go find Prince Rillian. Because narratively, that's all you need.
When you give them the bullet... When you give them the Cliff Notes version, there's no way for the audience to be in the to process with the character, and the especially in Silver Chair, the audience, the reader processes with Jill more than any other character.
She's the
They're
character.
Reasoning through her line of thought, and so you have to be able to do that in this
I
scene
agree.
Too. So what's one of the first? Well, what is the first thing that came to you on your list? Not necessarily the number one or most important, but.
Well, I was trying to think of something kind of general that would apply to the film as a whole. And so my number one was that The Silver Chair be a small movie. And probably initially people hear that and go, what? You know, but small in terms of it's just a story of this girl, Jill. She gets into Narnia and she has something to learn. She has no one in her life she can trust. And now she's in a place where she kind of has no choice but to trust this lion who's actually kind of scary. And to just be about that and not constantly feel like, oh, all Narnia is in danger. And yes, at the end we do find out that all Narnia was in danger, but we don't know that until the very end of the book that, you know, there was any threat to Narnia. So I would like to, that's at least one of the reasons that came to mind is they're always talking about making Narnia bigger and better and awesome and it's 1,000 versus 1,000,000 and all that. And obviously there's a lot of scale. You know, Underland should be this giant hole in the ground, and there should, you know, obviously they go to a giant city, for heaven's sake. Obviously there should be, you know, scale. But just in terms of the story, it's kind of like how the first half hour of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe felt, where it's just Lucy going into this world and meeting Mr. Tumnus. And so just in terms of following Jill Pohl's journey and not always feeling like it's the whole world is on the line.
Jill, a girl from our world,
exactly.
Will discover that she is
not a new hope for Narnia. The fate of one will decide the destiny of all. So that's number one for me. I want a pretty small, intimate, character-driven Narnia movie. So what's number two for you?
My second thing would be, I want the art direction and the craftsmanship of the set design, the props, costumes, all of that to require zero suspending disbelief. It's something that maybe, I don't know how many people really think about it, but when I whatever kind of movie I watch that takes place in a fictional world, obviously I want the characters to be relatable. I don't want it to just seem completely fake and all that. But you know, when you watch movies that are just like a contemporary drama, comedy, whatever, that's what you focus on because there are other distractions that are gotten rid of. And what I mean is you look at the world around them and it's our world. You look and like, oh, there's a car. I know what cars look like. I know how a car works. That's what a car would look like. You have to suspend any kind of disbelief for their environment because it's always realistic. With fantasy films, with sci-fi films, it's a lot harder. And whenever I watch anything, whether it's the old Star Wars or the new Star Wars or the not that I've seen them for years, or Star Trek or X-Men or I'm going to be thinking about this when I watch Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm going to be looking at, does that world look like a world that's lived in? Does it look real? Does it look like, can I just take a glance and just kind of, okay, I have to suspend disbelief because that looks like the tools, the ships, all look fake. And that was one of the things that I liked a little more about Prince of Caspian than Line Limits the Wardrobe.
More lived in.
I loved the work that Weta did. I loved the work that Weta did with Prince Caspian. I would actually like it to be a little more lived in than even Prince Caspian. I felt like all of those were a little bit too clean, too fairy tale-ish. I really hope that they go back to Bigatures.
Yeah.
I hope that they use Bigatures in this film. I really, really do. I hope that
for the Giant City, for Underland, maybe Cara Paravel. Because certainly you do compare Prince Caspian to Lionel's Wardrobe, and Caspian, to me, struck a much more pleasant balance of, it does have a fairy tale idealism to it, but it also feels lived in and real.
As whether it is makeup or CGI, I don't want to see anything and think, wow, that's great CGI, that's great makeup, that's great. I just want to see it. As opposed to, you know, The Hobbit, where I'm going, whoa, that's kind of an impressive looking special effects display there. And the same with Glumpuddle.
I mean, there it was.
The same with Puddle Glum. I want to look and say, oh, that's Puddle Glum. I don't want to look and say, oh, so that's the legs look pretty good there, you know.
Okay. So my second one is the character ages. According to Lewis's timeline, Jill and Eustace are 9. Now, maybe that would be to try to have actual 9-year-olds doing it. And I've heard a lot of Narnia Webbers make the argument, okay, Lewis's timeline might say they're 9, and I accept that as being canon. But when I read the book, I just don't see 9-year-olds doing these things and saying and talking like that. This doesn't sound like dialogue to a 9-year-old to me. And to an extent, I kind of agree with that. So I'm okay with them aging them up a little bit. But basically, my second one is I would like them to remain kids. So probably maybe 10, 11, 12 kind of range. And I would just think that there'd be this temptation to make them more like, you know, 16 or 17. To really see kids. And obviously that makes casting even more crucially important than it actually is. And particularly with Eustace, because he's been in Narnia before, you got to create the sense that he has this mysterious wisdom beyond his years somewhere in there. Honestly, like, I'm pretty much, maybe this could have been one of my things, but... And actually, Narnia Fan 7 wrote in and with this concern of basically saying, don't bother trying to fit this in with the Dawn Treader film. Just kind of pretend it never happened. And I am pretty much saying, don't worry about trying to match Will Poulter in any way. Let's just make a good Silver Chair movie and not worry about trying to be maybe some things, but like let's not be shackled down by trying to be consistent with the Dawn Treader movie. Yeah, I'm pretty much saying recast Will Poulter and maybe even have a younger actor than Will Poulter was when he filmed Dawn Treader. You know, like I'd be fine with that.
Especially if, you know, when you have the whole discussion of Peter and Susan and then eventually Lucy and Edmund being too old. At some point, you know, if you were to cast 16-year-olds, you think, wait a second. You know? And I'm not even talking just of a film. I'm talking about if the audience has that idea in their minds that, Aslan, for some reason, brings children. Uh-huh. There's a reason he brings children. He doesn't bring adults.
By knowing me here for a little, you might know me better adults. There. All right, so character age is my second one. So number three for you, your Silverchair wish list.
Oh, this is difficult. I really want them to include the scene with Aslan and the children and Caspian's resurrection. I think that
at the very end in Aslan's country,
that's very important. And even just the fact that Aslan literally spills his blood for Caspian to be able to come back to life, and Caspian actually being young again, and this whole, and you get a whole nother layer of, we kind of got this concept of Aslan's country and Dawn Treader, and this adds a whole new dimension to it, seeing Caspian come alive again. And I want that scene in the movie, and I want the emotion of that scene, the emotion that we get reading the book, to be conveyed in the movie.
Yeah, and that's one of the scenes, like, it was kind of like a, might almost equate it to Bacchus and Silenus and Prince Caspian, where it's like, oh, are they going to include that scene? Because that scene's kind of really hard to do right. And it's a critical scene when you look at the series as a whole. It's not narrative essential. It doesn't have anything to do with Rillian. But it is something that, because so much of the theme of the series is longing and, you know, believing that there is something else beyond this world. And that's kind of what Narnia kind of tickles in me, the hope and belief that maybe this world isn't all that there is. So it's so thematically important to have that idea that, look, you ultimately can trust Aslan. Even though Caspian's died, Aslan's got it covered.
If you cut out that scene, then the whole story becomes, Aslan sees a problem in Narnia and he brings the children to solve it. And then after they finish their quest, everything's happy, jolly, and yay! And that's their nice little package. Take it out, walk out of the theater with it, and you don't have to think about anything after watching the movie. It's all wrapped up nice, and it's not story central, plot central, but it is Narnia central.
I've had a feeling they'll find another way to do it. My feeling is the only way to do it in terms of pacing is to basically say, sort of do it as kind of an epilogue. Where you really feel like, okay, the movie's ending, and it's going to end on kind of a downer note with Caspian dying, but at least, you know, Rillian's back, and he got to see his son one more time. I think it's going to be bittersweet. And then to say, hang on, we've got something else, which might be the thing they would tend to avoid. There's that kind of, oh, wait, one more scene. That's usually what they try to avoid in movies, but I think that's kind of the only way to do it. So, tricky scene to get right. But, yeah, I do think it's just really important.
And there's a lot of scenes you could say there on chopping block. I think, like, the chasing the bullies at the end would be on the chopping block. But
that's awesome.
It is. But even though, as I think about the overall impact, cutting that out versus cutting out the scene where Caspian dies and then comes back, there's not even a comparison in my mind. Maybe there would be for some people, but...
Mm-hmm.
So, what... Okay. Is Glumpuddles number three. Almost said Puddleglum. Congratulations.
My number three on Silverchair Wishlist. This is going to shock everybody. Oh, my God.
Say it so.
No, I know. Everyone's going to wonder, what? This just in. But the last thing on my wish list has to do with Puddleglum. Shocking, I know. And even a few different people mentioned this, including Manise wrote in about this. But it's that Puddleglum not be a depressed character. I have a Narnia calendar that I ordered online that unfortunately is not available anymore, but it has some really great artwork. And for July it was Puddleglum, and I tweeted this picture and I put it on my Facebook page. But the picture of Puddleglum, and he just looks so sad. He has this, I mean, it's an upside down U, his mouth. He looks so depressed. He just looks so sad, and it's so easy if you just kind of read Silverchair kind of quickly. It's like, oh yeah, Puddleglum, he's really sad. But the truth is, it's the opposite. He's always talking about putting a bold face on things. He always has this tendency to assume the worst is going to happen, but then he has this desire to frame that in the best possible way. Oh, we're going to be trapped down here in Underland forever. You know, the bright side of this is that it's going to save funeral expenses. And I understand that the opposite is true as well, that when things seem to be going kind of well, he also has a tendency to say, oh no, the worst is, but, you know, he'll kind of twist it around and say, oh, this is actually really bad. But he's really has this, he's always is let's frame things in the worst possible way, and then let's put a bold face on it, which kind of makes sense as a coping mechanism. So, and it, really, a lot of the kind of comedic side of Puddle Glum is that he's always trying to be kind of optimistic. So although he's always voicing the worst case scenario, he's always trying to, he's not sad. He says things that are kind of sad and pessimistic, but he himself is not a sad character. And I think that's critically important that he not just be this Eeyore, oh, woe is me, everything is going to be terrible kind of character. And I just had felt the need to say that because that seems like such an easy trap to fall into. Yeah, like, despite assuming the worst, he actually is still a happy person.
I think, I'm glad you put that on your wish list, because I think, as we've talked about all the pitfalls, whether it's scenes that will likely be on the chopping block or
making the film the most epic as release of 2029 or whatever
it comes out, or that, I think that you've probably hit on what I think would be the easiest pitfall for a person who is, yeah, you know, this is a faithful adaptation. We haven't done this, we haven't done that, but we have this beloved character of Puddle Glum who is really, he's such a pessimist, you know, and that's what's adorable about him. And it would be so easy for someone to say that.
It'd be really easy to do that, yeah.
Yeah.
And that, it would not be Puddle Glum. And I think there might even be people that have read the book might even say, oh yeah, Puddle Glum, he's just always really sad. But I think even those people, when they see it, it's like, wait a second, that's not the Puddle Glum I remember from the book.
Yeah.
Okay, so those are our three.
There it is.
Those are the only things you want out of the Silver Chair movie. No. Not a comprehensive list. You could have done 300. But those are the three that I just thought would be most interesting to talk about. But we've got plenty of other stuff that people have sent in. Believe it or not, we're not the only people that actually have some opinions about the Silver Chair
movie.
That is
true.
Can you believe it? But Elias wrote in and wanted the serpent transformation scene to be kind of exactly as it's described in the book. I'm not sure exactly what they mean by that as far as the physical transformation or the way the scene is done itself. I mean, you know, the book describes, you know, the witch's arms kind of snapped to her waist and all that, and but just that be a really shocking scene. Certainly, it's really important. I think I would like that to be a big reveal, because, you know, like we talked about in the book commentaries, it's so obvious in the book that this is to an extent, I think, intentional, but it's really obvious in the book that the witch is the serpent. You know, you kind of assume that immediately. But I think, what if the serpent wasn't green? So that maybe we wouldn't immediately say, oh, the witch is the serpent. That's just an example. So that when she becomes a serpent, it's like, oh, it's her.
This just came to me.
That'd be a reveal.
I could very easily see them setting it up as she commands serpents.
Uh-huh.
And like she could just command them and will them to do things. And so people just assume, oh, she sent one of her serpents to kill the queen. And then at the end you find out that she did.
Oh, it's actually
she
her.
Is the... I could see them doing something like that.
Yeah, but yeah, one way or another, I would like that to be a reveal.
We've mentioned Manise and her wishes for the story. She had a couple others. One, she said they must show Bism.
That's hard.
It would be hard.
Do I want them to
That'll
show
be
Bism?
On the chopping block. You know it will.
It absolutely will be. And do I want them to show Bism? Absolutely. Or at least, I don't know if Manise literally means show Bism, because we never quite see Bism in the book. Or if she just means the scene itself. But to even really show Bism in any developed way where Golg is talking about it, and that whole thing of the conflict Rillian has about do I go to Bism or not, really hard thing to get into the movie. Thematically, very important to show the gnomes discovering where they came from and the joy they experience when they realize, oh, wait a second, you know, I can go home now. This isn't my real home. But yeah, I love to see it in there. I just don't know if it can work well.
I could see them just cutting it out because, again, they might say, I mean, really, would Rillian be considering leaving everything to go down to Bism when he's just been freed from under... that's not realistic for the character. But even just to show it so the audience realizes that there's this whole... I mean, Narnia is a world where the world ends, it's flat, it's not round, and there's a whole other world underneath the Earth's crust.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it'd be
amazing. I don't think they'll be able to show it in such a... They'll be able to develop the idea as much as Lewis did, certainly.
To let the audience know it's there. You know, it's kind of funny because Manise mentioned the scene with Aslan and Jill and how it's going to be really central
to the story.
A couple
people mentioned that, yeah, critical scene.
To focus on Jill's trust for Aslan. And Anquinos said the same thing. Basically, they have to nail that scene. So
it's just the foundation of the movie in a lot of ways.
It really sets it all up. He also mentioned the Parliament of Owls scene.
And that's tricky because, you know, are they just going to do a big, long flashback like they do in the book? Or are they going to they gonna do a prologue at the beginning of the movie? How are they going to convey all that information? Are they going to try to keep the mystery of, oh, it was the queen that killed her? Or are they going to not even show that it's a snake? You know, are they going to show Rillian's face so we don't – maybe they won't show his face so we don't recognize him later? Yeah, there's a lot of things about this, you know, this – you know, exposition scene that, you know, how are they going to do it? It's a lot of story points to get across.
Yep. He also mentioned, and this would this scene could easily have been up there with the two scenes that I basically want them to include and nail in the story, the There Is No Narnia scene. That's arguably just as important.
Yeah, and again, that to an extent will be on the chopping block, as you can see them really skipping through that really quick.
Well, we already know.
That
quick
moment.
When they're saying that dialogue is awkward, what scene are they talking about?
Yeah,
it's got it. They're thinking about that scene.
And it's a. You can easily see them just being like, for a second, it's like some kind of mind trick. Oh no, Jill's forgetting about Narnia. Wave the magic wand to make it stop. You know, make it more of an action scene. So I could see this to an extent being on the chopping block because, oh, it's a long dialogue scene. We need a bigger action moment here. Tricky scene to get right. But just that whole idea of the Lady of the Green Kirtle trying to make people forget why they're here and where they came from, which is exactly the game that she played with Jill and Eustace when she tried to make them focus more on hot baths at Harfang than their mission, the whole reason they're here. That's such a crucial part of the story in her character, so they have to have that scene in here in some form.
It is. Maybe you should cover, and we'll start with Anquinos as a postscript and post-postscript, but you can cover the anti-wishes, because we actually got a number of anti-wishes.
Right, things we don't want, which I had one of them too.
I guess qualifies, it's specific, and it can be on the top three.
Right, but in that scene, Anquinos is fearful of, please don't tie this into the green mist, which is kind of related to what Narnia Fan 7 said about, look, just ignore the Dawn Treader movie. And a couple people said that, please, let's not do the whole green mist thing. It'd be very easy in this scene to, when the witch throws the powder on the fire, to say, oh, it's the green mist somehow. And I just prefer, because of, and actually, that it kind of the reasons why I dislike the green mist is kind of in Anquinos' post-postscript, is, you know, Lucy saying, don't give into temptation, and there's no subtlety in it. So it's when I, as a moviegoer, kind of discover things, oh, I get that, I relate to that, rather than just being told about it, I usually have a deeper experience with it, a much more powerful, interesting experience with it. So rather than just say, oh, you see this green smoke? This is temptation. No, let me figure out the thing of temptation and what's going on.
It's at some point, it's insulting to your audience. And
I think we can say all this because no doubt about it, most fans did not like the green mist, and would just prefer
even
they
people
forget
who defended
it.
The Voyage of the Dawn Treader did not like the green mist. So
right, so I would just like them to have just kind of forget about it in this movie.
I'm gonna mention this is a tweet from Hannah B. She said for her list, she says something I don't want in the film: romance! !
Which is another reason why I would like to my second one was keeping the characters pretty young. If they have 12-year-olds, much less likely to see the romance issue that they, you know, kind of shoehorned into Prince Caspian with Caspian and Susan.
Especially with any succeeding story. And an email from Rebecca said, "Dear Narnia Web Council, one thing that has always worried me is they may feel the need to put in changes to the movie to increase their audience instead of trusting that the story itself will bring the audience, especially now that it is an independent company. One of the things I am worried about is a romance or new characters being added to relate to a larger audience. Do you guys think that this problem will be worse because it is an independent company, or would a company with a lot more money be more likely to create extra scenes?"
So basically, I think it's like, are we more or less likely to see more changes and more kind of desperate way I see it, desperate attempts to appeal to as many people as possible and their dog. Is a big budget make those kind of changes more or less likely? I think a smaller budget makes these kind of changes less likely. Because one of the reasons why every Hollywood movie seems to have romance and seems to have this thread amount of humor in action, because they're so expensive and they're so big, we have to try to appeal to as many people as we possibly can in order to... So very, very, very different kinds of people have to like... They're trying to make them like the same movie. And that's why I think a lot of movies kind of feel, you know, less fulfilling, because they're trying to appeal to everybody. So if you're making a smaller budget movie, you don't have to appeal to as many people
right.
to recoup your investment. I think we're
True.
Less likely to see these kinds of changes.
I would agree. With a smaller film, with less money on the table, and not expecting as much back... And you're absolutely right that with big films, they really do... It's almost like a science. Like... They figure out, hey, if we put this plug in and this plug in and plug this in here and put this story element in here, either we'll appeal to this many people. A perfect, I think the best example, and it's really, I mean, as a, you know, the artists don't like it, but as a business, as a Hollywood businessman, you would love Michael Bay. Like, look at Transformers 1. No, really. Look at, which is really the only one I actually kind of, you know, it's like a popcorn flick, but look at Transformers 1. Look at the comedians you have. Look at the actors. You have a romance. You have Herbie the Love Bug. Okay. You have the Herbie story. You have the military guys. I mean, the first half hour of the film was almost like Black Hawk Down. You know, you have the military guy component, you have the talking robots, you have the slapstick almost slipping on a, you know, like a giant robot banana peel, and then you have the kissing, and you have, you know, good looking people, and you know, it's just, it's like, hey, we're going to plug in all these different people, and, you know, oh yeah, that way we'll put this guy in here and put this guy, oh yeah, this put this comedian
in here.
It's
just all about trying to keep things that...
And it'll appeal to a lot of people, and they'll see it,
right.
We'll make money, money.
And really, and I guess I'm trying to make it clear why this is potentially an issue. J.K. Rowling, there's an interview with her that was done. She was almost finished writing the last Harry Potter book. And that's when it was recorded. And she said, for some people to love it, other people must loathe it. And I think what she's getting at is if you try to appeal to every single person, even people that are very, very different people who like different kinds of movies and like, well, how can I make a movie that both of them will like? So it kind of has something for each of them. It's almost like a big compromise. And I think that, yeah. So when you have a smaller movie, there are less people you have to appeal to in order to recoup your investment. You're more free to say, well, there's the people that do like this kind of thing, there's enough of them out there that they'll see the movie and they'll like it. So that's why I keep saying overall that the small budget thing is probably more of a good thing than a bad thing for them.
And
movie.
Hopefully, I don't know, that I like that quote. I'm going to think about it some more. But you know, as I think about it, hopefully, I'm saying this off the cuff, there will be people who watch The Silver Chair who say, I really just didn't like the movie because I don't enjoy road trip movies. Or I really didn't enjoy the movie because I don't enjoy... children's stories, even if it's written for adults to appreciate.
Or maybe like I didn't like the movie because I wanted just a bunch of cool battles.
Yeah,
and
because
I didn't
there
like
wasn't
all the
I just
stuff.
Only enjoy action movies, or I only
like
enjoy
like
romance
if they
movies.
Said, oh, I just thought all the character stuff was boring. I just wanted action. And if they said that, I'd be like, I'm not going to say the movie did something wrong. It's like, well, to me, it sounds like the movie did something right.
Yeah.
If that kind of person doesn't like the movie, probably means the movie did something
uh-huh.
right. So rather than try to appeal to everybody, let's just try to appeal to. You know,
yeah.
A certain number of, you know, a smaller number of people. Well, great. So those are, once again, that's about 0.002% of the, you know, desires and thoughts we have on the Silver Chair movie.
But at least they're on our minds.
Right. And when I go see the movie, I really try to just accept the movie for what it is and judge it on that mm-hmm. level. Not, well, I wish they'd done this. I wish they'd done that. Now, make no mistake. I'll write about it and I'll talk about it. I wish they'd done this and that, but also be able to evaluate the movie where
sure.
is it a good movie or isn't it? Just on its own terms, does it work? And try to accept it, even if it's not like the book, even if it's not like what I would have done or what I wanted. To number one, watch the movie and say, well, what is it as a movie by itself? But anyway, movie comes out. We don't know when or even
necessarily. Yeah,
2029
was that was something I was saying to be, it was hyperbole. It's probably going to be closer to 2018.
Yeah, that's guess. What
I mean,
we're hoping.
We don't know. We have no idea. Everyone's saying, just so everyone knows, everyone is saying 2018 because everyone is saying 2018. We really don't know.
That's just kind of that's kind of the speculation at this point. Well, great. So I'm not sure what we'll do next, if we'll continue the Horse and His Boy commentary or if we'll get some Silver Tear news. But you know, I just might go reread a bit of the Silver Tear right now and just hope and dream.
There you go.